man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Howdy, 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 everybody. I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm sitting in this week as host for Who Shot Ya? Welcome to the program, and joining me today in the virtual booth, as always, the Queen of the Midwest, film festival programmer, producer extraordinaire, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
Well, tying into the Queen of the Midwest in absentia, I have to add always.
You're like the Dauphine, you know.
Yes. Ooh, I like a Dauphine.
Dauphine, Drea.
Right? I'll take it. Everyone Google that. Enjoy. So I'm partaking once again in the Screen Drafts podcast. And you may or may not remember the last time I did it, I did this Westerns thing. I was watching Westerns for months. The draft I'm doing later tonight, the theme is Minnesota, and we are drafting movies set in, shot in, and or both Minnesota movies. I'm so excited, and the weirdness that's come up of like the research, the range of movies that I was not expecting, the range of languages I was not expecting. But the one hint I'll give you, because this will be out by the time, I won't be spoiling you guys, Elaine May's The Heartbreak Kid is like partially in Minnesota, and it becomes a whole thing, and damned if I wasn't excited to figure that out. I mean, I've probably spoken before about how Charles Grodin in The Great Muppet Caper like shaped my sexuality. So him in The Heartbreak Kid, it's like, it's a whole thing. It's amazing. But, anyway, that's what's good with me.
Did you find the way to Graffiti Bridge?
Alonzo, I can always count on you for like knowing the inside bits. Yes. I'm super excited about this, and it's been a very fun deep dive. You guys, Minnesota, it's just rich with culture and background. Casey knows what I'm talking about.
And incident, yes, no doubt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of excitement, it's always an exciting day when we're joined by friend of the podcast, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, Ms. Ingu Kang. Welcome. What's good?
Hello. I think my what's good is Drag Race UK. Oh. I think like any self-respecting fan of RuPaul's Drag Race, I have an extremely complicated, increasingly souring relationship with RuPaul Charles.
He is a fracker.
Yes. Among many other things. And I think the sort of OG Drag Race has been like a major, sorry for this, like drag this season. Mm. But the international spinoffs have been just like the new blood that like Peter Thiel needs in order to refresh himself. And so last year, Canada's Drag Race debuted. It was amazing. It was like the best season of Drag Race I had seen in a very long time. And right now I'm watching Drag Race UK. It's on wowpresents.com or wowpresents plus. I forget. You can look it up. It is just a smorgasbord of British accents. And it's just delightful. You have like a bunch of, I feel like one of the things about Drag Race is that it's gotten very professionalized. And so there's a lot of polish. But I think there is sort of like this like edgier, rawer element that is basically no longer present on the show, or at least harder to find. And I think Drag Race UK still has a lot of that. And so, yeah, that is like literally the only thing making me happy these days. But what's good with you, Alonzo?
No, wait, before then, I have to chime in a quick drag
please,
race
please,
thing.
Please, please, please.
Because I do need, of course, to shout out to Utica, the Minnesota drag queen on the regular one, who's total art school weirdo, and I love her. Although I do feel Ingu all around in the higher tier of both artistry and drama in the UK. That's going on.
Well,
oh my God.
There's something to be said about early seasons of reality TV shows. Like mm-hmm. I remember, you know, Kelly Clarkson talks about how the first season of American Idol was super on the cheap and nobody knew that it was going to be a thing and nobody cared about it. And, you know, watching The Real World Homecoming on Paramount Plus is a reminder that that first season of The Real World, the rules and archetypes that very quickly were established for reality TV by The Real World were still kind of in the office. offering. So when those people auditioned to be on that show and were cast on that show, they did not walk into that house with the same expectations that everybody else did in all the subsequent seasons, because it had now been done before, you know.
Plus, at this stage of sort of like reality TV, a lot of people sort of go in with sort of like their post-series influencer careers, like, all set up and ready to go.
Sure.
And, of course, a lot of these British drag queens are also thinking that way, too. They're entrepreneurs, like, at their core, right? But, yeah, I think it's just not as cynical yet. And you can really see that in the show.
Cool.
But what's good with you, Alonzo?
Yes, no, I'm sorry.
To answer your question, Ingu. Well, what's good with me, I do love getting to beat the drum, as always, for physical media. And the Criterion Collection announced this week that we're getting two very exciting releases in June for Pride Month. One is a gorgeous new Blu-ray of Dee Reese's brilliant debut feature, Pariah, with a insanely great lead performance from Adepero Oduye. And then also they're putting out the a collection called The Signifying Works of Marlon Riggs, which is a complete filmography of Marlon Riggs, who is was just such a hugely influential queer black filmmaker in the 1980s, talking about race and sexuality and AIDS in a way that a lot of filmmakers just were not doing yet. It also includes a great documentary about his life. But his work is so incredibly eclectic. It's from the very sort of poetic and experimental Tongues Untied to a documentary that, Ingu, if you've never seen, you would, I think, really love, called Color Adjustment, about the history of black representation on network television. He was an extraordinary director, died of AIDS complications in the mid-90s, and leaves behind a really amazing legacy. It's so great that all of these films are going to be available in one collection. So I'm really thrilled that Criterion is doing this. So that's what's good with me. Big show today. We've got, that awards thing. We'll be talking about that. But really, we're here to talk about Minari, which people on Twitter have been saying, when are you going to talk about Minari? Now. Now is the time that we're going to talk about Minari. We'll be taking a call from the Who Shot line and, of course, staff picks. But before that, our Itadic section, which is generally short for Is This Important? Do I Care? But this week, we're just going to be talking about the nominations for the 93rd Academy Awards, which were announced this past week. That's just going to be this whole segment this time. So I'm just going to cut to the chase and ask you guys, what is important and what do you care about?
What a dick.
I think the thing that really stuck out to me is that I think previously the Academy had nominated something like 4 or 5 women directors in its entire nearly century-long history. And for the very first time in the year of our Lord 2021, there are 2 women directors nominated in that category. I really like one of those movies. I really did not like one of the other movies represented in that category. You can try to guess which one if you want. But the fact that a woman has authored a movie and that doesn't strike against the movie somehow still feels like progress in this terrible industry. I care about that.
And one of those women was the first woman of color to be nominated. So,
yes.
Strides everywhere.
Yes.
I mean, little mouse steps, I would say. But
you're right. Baby steps.
Baby steps everywhere. Yeah. No, I agree. I think there was something really satisfying about that beyond the idea of liking the movies, because certainly every year there's male directors nominated whose movies I did not like. So that even the broadness of like, oh, how wonderful, there's enough women. I'm a fan of both of the women and both of the films that they were directed, which was Nomadland and Promising Young Woman. But it's that thing we say of like, if it's a monolith and you have to represent everything, you can't be bad at all. Of like, oh, good. The more you get in there, the more variety you can have to your response. But as someone who's in communication with so many female filmmakers all the time, there was such an encouragement taken from that of, like, please let this be a building block. Please not an anomaly. Please this something that we can see more and more of. And I think that's also true in the acting categories. What is
Wait, before you move on, can I just add one thing? And I think it's sort of important to note that the Oscars are bullshit, but it's important to have representation in the Oscars because it's a reflection of how the industry thinks and who is going to get money for future projects.
Yeah.
And so even though the Oscars are bullshit, we still kind of have to care about them.
And how much money they'll make for those. Like, your bid goes up when you become a nominee, and then the money the film will make goes up. Like, there's something about the kind of, you know, we've spoken about this a lot, that I find a frustration all the time of the movies that we recognize as Oscar worthy or an awards type movie. I think it's such a limiting range of what's generally in that. To see that broaden even a little bit would feel very encouraging.
But and I think there are, you know, always there are a lot of people out there who will now be compelled to go see some of these movies because they have the Academy imprimatur on them. And I just did a podcast with our friend Tim Grierson, who said that somebody that he knows, one of his relatives or somebody, was like, so have you been reviewing furniture this year? Because there's no movies, right, with the theaters closed? He's like, no, there's been a ton. And so I think the Oscar nominations for a lot of people are like, these films exist in the world and were a thing, even though I couldn't go see them in the traditional way. So, you know, now it's like, all right, well, then it's on Netflix, it's on Hulu, I can watch this now. Oh, well, then I guess I will.
That's a great point, because the Oscars, one of their huge functions is just
selling
a larger
tickets.
It's a marketing mechanism, right? And that's why they put so much money in. Again, something else we love to talk about, if people don't know the behind the scenes of the money that goes into getting nominations, because nominations pay off in ticket sales. And especially like this year, if there is a broad swath of people, including many I'm related to, who may or may not think that there's any films that came out. And so, yeah, being that and being like, oh, these are Oscar worthy, so there were new films and they're good, because, you know, the more you're in an industry, the more you see the creaks and ugliness, and the further out you're like, oh, sparkle. So
I also do think that this is a unusual year in that a lot of the usual Oscar bait has not been rewarded. I think a lot of the choices tend to be more critical darlings that maybe have not made as much money, or like would not have made as much money. I think Minari is maybe sort of like on the cusp.
Well, we also have to remember that a lot of the films that would have been Oscar bait this year got kicked to next year, or to 2021 rather, because they wanted to have them in theaters. So, you know, this would have been a year where In the Heights would have been in the conversation, where Steven Spielberg's West Side Story would have been in the conversation, where Fast 9 would have been in the conversation.
Definitely. Best picture.
You know, but now we have the next Oscars to look forward to for that.
Before we jump into anything else, like an exciting commercial break, I do definitely want to talk about the actors, because I think there's something really cool there too. I might be have this number wrong, but is it 9 out of the 12 nominated
of the 20 nominated actors, only 4 of them are white Americans?
Yes. Which is great. White Americans. We've been getting a lot of them over the years. I don't know if you noticed that, but like...
Sink back a little, you guys.
Yeah, we've been covered.
Like,
anyway.
The last time that two black women competed against each other for Best Actress was in 1972. And back then, one of them was playing Billie Holiday.
No.
Yeah, nice. So it was Cicely Tyson and Diana Ross. So,
yeah.
You know, so that's bonkers that it took this long to circle back to that. And
to have someone else play Billie Holiday.
That too. But I think in all the categories,
we're two black women this year.
Viola Davis and Andra Day.
Both playing real life singers of that era.
Well, the Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield are, of course, also playing real life people.
And neither of them is the lead in their own movie, apparently, even though they're both the title roles.
Isn't that bonkers? That's, like, Where they decided, oh, this isn't a two-hander. This is you're both supporting each other.
Apparently, yeah. Well, and this is the thing. Like, you know, the studios will push people in certain categories, but then voting bodies can do whatever they want. Like, LA Film Critics a lot of times will say, well, no, that's not supporting. It's a lead. They were pushing Stanfield for actor and Kaluuya as supporting, which I think would have been better for the studio because then they wouldn't be up against each other. I think now they're both in the same category. They're going to kind of divvy out, you know, their support. It's a Betty Davis and Ann Baxter in All About Eve situation, you know.
Oh, isn't it? That's exactly what Lakeith Stanfield said when he heard.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like, and I'm Betty Davis.
Yeah.
How were you guys surprised?
It is weird that, you know, like I'm used to the never getting anything I want from this body. But my favorite film of 2020 was Collective, and it did manage to score a double international and documentary nomination. So I was very excited about that.
Collective's fantastic, and it's one of the few redeemable things. I'm actually further behind on the internationals this year than I am in previous years, largely because of the theater situation. But in what I have followed, they took some wild either swings or missteps, depending on who you talk to, for the international. And that's probably the category that I think has the saddest results in terms of like what I've heard great things about and then what did not actually make it.
Well, yeah, there were a lot of shortlisted films that I think people were shocked that didn't make it all the way, that, you know, like I'm No Longer Here and La Llorona and Night of the Kings.
Yeah,
I have not seen them all myself, so I can't judge. But people I know who do like really follow this stuff, or there's a couple of those nominees who are like, what?
Yeah.
But I love Collective and I love Another Round, so I'll stand for those, you know.
Yes. Some gems amongst the question marks.
Now, what is there anything that you kind of actively cringed over? I mean, I had a few. I think first and foremost, The Return of the Chicago 7.
Yes.
I just think that movie is 10 different kinds of baloney. And I'm stunned that it did as well as it did. And I'm glad that Vinterberg got the Sorkin slot, frankly, in that category, if that was ever going to be his. I don't
Truth.
Know. But what about y'all?
Pixar's Onward, which is one of the dullest animated features I have sat through in quite a while. Also, I mean, I guess this wasn't really your question, but I was really bummed out that First Cow didn't get anything. That was my favorite movie of 2020. And it's not anything remotely resembling Oscar's material. But if there was ever a year where critical adoration was going to help a movie get into that conversation, it was this year. So bummer.
Yeah,
First Cow,
agree.
Never Early, Sometimes Always, and Kajillionaire, I think all were big misses.
I'm making
for me
a face. I'm making a Miranda July face.
Oh no. No, I fully agree on First Cow. That was one and that you're to your point of if there was a time that a good campaign could have been made for it. Yeah, I totally agree. Gary Oldman, get out of that category, like take a nap. Are you kidding me? As you know, I didn't like the casting of that in general, so it's not entirely that I'm faulting his performance of him being a grown-ass man in his 60s playing a 40-something drunk. But Jewish drunk, like, I just, ugh, stop. But come on. Like, again, if we're looking at lead characters and breaking the mold, yes, fine. In the words of our favorite kind of movie tagline, competent, like sure.
I don't know who came up with that.
And you know, it is not every so often, or actually I guess periodically, you'll get like a big nominee, you know, big best picture, blah blah blah, but then they don't nominate the screenplay, you know, like Titanic or whatever, but that they don't nominate the screenplay for a movie that is a celebration of screenwriting, that just tells you a lot right there, I think. Anyway, we're going to leave it there. I'm sure we'll have other things to say during this seemingly endless award season. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about Minari here on Who Shot Ya?
All right, we are back with our friends Storyblocks, who continue to support us. Storyblocks is dedicated to being the world's best royalty-free stock media subscription service with an ever-growing library of stock assets, including music, images, sound effects, and more.
They have affordable subscription plans and tools. And with Storyblocks Unlimited All Access Plan, you can get unlimited downloads of everything in their library. And even if your subscription ends, everything you've downloaded is yours to keep. In 2020, Storyblocks launched Restock, an initiative to increase diversity in their library. Storyblocks is committing to having 20% of their footage contain Black, Indigenous, and people of color by 2022, with plans to expand their scope to include more underrepresented groups in the future.
And we've spoken before about what exactly you can get out of Storyblocks. For me, I think the parts that I find most interesting are if you need to flesh out a short video piece you're doing, if it's an insert, if it's an aerial shot, if it's a crowd shot, if it's, oh, I need to indicate that they're near a river, but I can't go film a river. This is exactly what you turn to something like this for. You can also use it if you are doing the title for something, or if you want like the lower thirds, if it in a documentary, and you want them beautifully designed, but you can't hire a graphic artist to go and do them. They have all of these templates in there built so that whatever you're making on video can look polished and professional and more refined and fancy. You can look fancy, and that's all we ever want.
We like fancy. Explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/whoshot. That's storyblocks.com/whoshot.
Hey folks, it's me, James Arthur M., host of Minority Corner, your home through these wild times for weekly doses of pop culture, history, news, nerdy stuff, and more through a BIPOC queer and allied lens. That's how you get Joel Schumacher putting nipples on Batman.
Yeah.
I didn't ask, this as a gay man, didn't ask for it. I don't need to see Batman's nipples on his suit. Who is this for?
I did a bunch of research. I wanted to just know about the history of Black people in Argentina. So not only did they erase Black people from their history, they also started to flip and use it as slurs.
We're not done. Like, we're not done with the work that needs to be done. And so stay awake. So join me and some of your new BFFs every Friday here on Maximum Fun to stay informed, empowered, and have some fun. Minority Corner, because together, we're the majority.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. And in the studio with me are
Drea Clark.
Ingu King.
Today we are talking about Minari, which got 6 Oscar nominations this week. Drea, would you mind providing us with a brief synopsis?
All right. So Minari follows a Korean-American family who has moved from California to the Ozarks, and they're settling into Arkansas in a very rural patch of the country. The father has moved there with a desire to grow a farm. I just lost my crown right there.
Farm a farm.
He's going to farm a farm. And he and his wife also sex chickens to pay the bills. And they have come there with their 2 small children. The wife is not happy about where they've landed, is very concerned, largely because their young son has a heart defect and they are in the country and further away from help. To appease her, her mother is flown in from Korea to give her a sense of comfort and to help watch the kids. And so it's them sort of struggling to make a space for themselves to start a whole endeavor and enterprise and business of sorts, and then to make sure that they're still connecting as a family and as the couple at the center of it, of finding their love or letting it go. So that is Minari in the most barest of strokes.
Thank you.
Farm a farm.
So this is a very autobiographical film from writer-director Lee Isaac Chung. And I think it, in a lot of ways, it kind of fits into the child of immigrants narrative, which is one that I always respond to. Ingu, were there moments in this that, obviously you grew up in the West Coast, not in the rural heartland, but just from the sense of the kind of Korean-American experience, sort of moments or little cultural pings that made you go, I feel seen?
Oh, this movie is a fucking trip. there's literally no other way to describe it. For, I think, like, the ages between zero-ish to 11, we live with one of my grandmothers, but there was this, like, whole couple of months where our other grandmother had actually come from Korea, I think after her husband died, my grandfather. And essentially, she had come to live with us. And it was just like a period of my life that I had mostly forgotten. And this movie brought so much of it back. It was like, yeah, it was basically like, oh no, all of my feelings, stop it. So yeah, by the way, I do not recommend having two grandmothers live in one household, just a nightmare situation. But the grandmother that I live with was like very mean. And so I remember hoping that the other grandmother who was coming from Korea would be like much nicer and would sort of be like the good grandma. And then it turned out she was like very like outwardly sweet, but also like very mean in like very different ways from like my current grandma. And so just like this idea of like you having these like very feminized, very sort of like age related expectations for somebody coming from a different country. Largely based on basically like American pop culture, and then having your grandmother basically not fit any of those expectations that you wanted. I was just like, why is this from my brain? And why is like my face so wet? Like, I don't understand. Why am I watching this movie? This is torture. Great movie.
So they played bad cop, worse cop with you then. Is that the
They played bad cop, like bad in a different way cop.
In bad my cop, head, bad they lieutenant. Yeah, they share a bed Willy Wonka style with their feet heads near each feet. Other. Exactly. That's interesting because my grandparents, who all lived in Nebraska, which is where the rest of my family's from, I think there's something about grandparents in general that I was so loved and beloved and just spoiled rotten. And I still was like, oh, grandma, like she's going to come and fuss over me because she thinks I'm perfect. It's rough to be me, you guys. I love hearing that background because there is something about this film that really does that beautiful specificity of story and giving us this like insight to a very particular experience, yet also touches on so many universals of the family, of the idea of there's this point, you know, when the parents are arguing and having like all the stress. They say one of the hardest things on a marriage are like having children and moving and like having a new job change, and this is sort of all of these things at once, and they're arguing, and the kids go in the other room and start writing on paper. Am I conflating this with another movie?
No, they say like stop okay. fighting or something.
They say
on paper
stop,
planes.
Don't fight. Okay, it's because I just started saying that. I was like, I just made that up. Nope, this did happen. But that idea of like that seems so relatable and also specific. And I think this is a script, if you look at it, and it's that it's some stories are sort of A to B to C, and you get your thing of like at the beginning of the scene, I need you to do this so that it cues in this next thing. And this is the kind of film that it's so much more fabric than that. There's so much like weaving in terms of, I could pick so many themes of, if I just watched this looking out for the idea of faith and how that comes up. And both in the prayers that are done, the church community that they end up going to, the one that they want to go to with the other Koreans that live in their area, how it, you know, like, the idea of even that the Mountain Dew they drink is like, oh, it's water from the mountain, as if it's been blessed or something. Like it's working on so many levels that you could follow all of those threads in such interesting ways. You could watch it just wondering about the father and the idea of the American dream in its purest form. And I love that. I love a film that's like trying to hit a lot of things rather than just, oh, I'm telling a story about a family.
I think that was the thing that I found so remarkable, because it tells like a very like, in some ways, like, very expansive story. And then in other ways, it's incredibly individualized. I think the characters are really archetypal in some ways, but then their interactions with each other are, like incredibly detailed. I love that you brought up the faith element, because when I watched this movie for the second time, that was one of the things that I most picked up on. The way everyone's like generally respects Monica's faith. Monica is the wife played by Han Yeri. But at the same time, like, her mom sort of like makes fun of her Christianity. Like, her husband is like not super sympathetic, and even though he probably also is a Christian. And so the little ways that like it feels very much like a family, I really appreciated.
Well, and, you know, Dave, who grew up in the evangelical church in the Southwest in the 80s, really said they really kind of nail the way that a church like that would react with the appearance of a minority family and this sort of like kind of patronizing, fawning that would happen. He was like, ooh, yeah, they're getting this just right. Also, the use of a very popular Michael W. Smith, Amy Grant song that pops up in one of the scenes.
I think also just going back to the American Dream part, I like that there is sort of like now this spate of Asian American movies that are starting to question this like sort of larger cultural narrative of like basically economic ascension and assimilation once you arrive in the U.S. I think Spa Night, which is another Korean American movie from a couple of years ago that Alonzo and I both love, set in LA.
I do too.
Andrew, we'll also include you.
Like, that's a really great movie about how all of the other Korean Americans sort of like seem to be able to have figured out a way like into this American dream, but the protagonist, who is also gay, like, has not. And I think The Farewell was also really great about this. And Minari is also just like one. I love that this is sort of like a larger trend explored within Asian American cinema, because that whole narrative of like, well, like, the first generation is going to come and like work like crazy, and then the second generation is going to like make it or whatever. That's true in a lot of cases. That's probably true in the case of my family. But I think that we need other perspectives. And I think Alonzo said earlier that this was a movie about the second generation. And I think what's really great is about this movie is that it's made by someone like from the second generation, but it's not actually about them. It's about like the immigrant parents. True. And I don't think you actually really get that perspective from a central point of view like all that often. And I think that's something that's also really different about this movie.
Weirdly enough, I think a movie that did that in an interesting way last year was, did you see the documentary The Donut King?
Yes. Love that. I programmed that at Bentonville.
I thought that was really fascinating that you had, you know, all of these people who were, you know, Cambodian refugees from the Vietnam War, like, you know, coming to America, building this chain of donut shops, working their asses off, and like the family coming to work there and like having this great success with it. And then after sending their kids off to like college and grad school and stuff, they did not want to inherit the business. They're off being like, you know, doctors and CPAs or whatever. And they're like, yeah, I'm not getting up at 5 or 4 to make donuts.
It is not like time to make the donuts. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of an interesting look at what the first wave does and all the sacrifices that they make, and then whether or not the rest of the family is there for that, or if they're moving on to other things. You know, Lee Isaac Chung went to Yale. He was not there to farm a farm, you know.
Not everybody can farm a farm. That has to be like something you want to do, is farm that farm.
I mean, I admittedly like Minari quite a bit. I don't love it as much as y'all do, but I respect it, and I think that it is doing the things that it sets out to do. Dave and I were talking about it this weekend, and I realized that it kind of reminds me of in the 80s, before like Sundance got sexy, you know, before literally Sex, Lies, and Videotape, when, you know, the kind of films you were getting were the more sort of earnest well-intentioned, you know, like basically anything written by Horton Foote after 1979, you know, that kind of thing. I sort of, that's kind of the vibe I get from this movie, but you know, I don't think it's doing anything wrong per se. I'm just, it's not grabbing me in the same way that even a film like Tiger Tail, which we talked about last year, and mm-hmm. I think I brought it up in the year-end episode when you picked this as your favorite. Like, that's also a film about immigrants and trying to kind of make it in the United States and deal with work stuff and raising kids and all the other things. And I feel like that movie kind of came and went and people didn't really talk about it. And
'cause it sucked.
Well, thanks, Ingu. But for me, it worked. And there were moments in it that rang true to me. You know, obviously, I'm not on a Taiwanese level, but certainly my parents were both, you know, immigrants of this country, and the stuff that they went through and their efforts to kind of make a community of other Spanish speaking people from whatever countries, you know, that were in Georgia, you know, those moments kind of. That to me felt like something I could relate to. And this movie was more, I don't know, I kind of felt like I was watching it from a bit of a remove. And maybe if I had gone to Sundance last year and been one of the first people to see it and had could see it without the expectations that had been placed upon it by all the people who raved about it all year, you know, then it might have been a different story. And that does figure into it, as much as we like to say that it doesn't.
I think that The first time that I watched this movie, it was also kind of ruined for me in the sense of, like, I had my expectations were just, like, too high, even though I tried to manage them. And then I appreciated all of the craft so much more the second time around. And I'm really glad that I watched it again for that reason. I think that it's maybe, like, a little bit hard to tell. And, of course, like, a movie should be able to translate, but there were so many elements where it just felt like really imported from like my own past. Like there was like this whole moment when the grandmother arrives, for example, where she opens up her luggage and it's full of food from Korea. And I was like, yep, been there. And then I think the little boy starts complaining about like her Korea smell. And I was like, yep, I can smell it. And then she made him this like brew of like traditional herbs. And I was like, yep, had that. And there were just like things in the trailer that is their home where I was like, yep, I recognize that. And just also the way that like all of the Korean dialogue was, which apparently Yoon Yoo-jung, the actress who plays the grandmother, helped translate for Lee Isaac Chung, her and her friend, who like basically just came by to like hang out on set, and then they ended up doing a lot of the translation for him. There's just like such a playfulness in the language, and I think that's something that is, I would say like fairly dominant in a lot of like Korean relationships is sort of like the way that like you pick at somebody that you love. I'm sure you guys can't relate in any way from like my interactions with you. And there's just like little ways that like the grandmother talks to the little boy where I was like, oh my God, like every single line of this dialogue does not feel like dialogue. It just feels like something that was like transcribed from life somewhere. And so as like movie-ish, as sort of cinematic as a lot of this movie was, the details were so impeccable and like, I don't know, maybe that's like a thing where like if you haven't lived this life or some version of this life, like you can't quite feel as much.
No,
want to note that like those details are there.
Sure. No, like I'll watch an Almodóvar movie or even like Veneno on HBO Max with Dave, and I will laugh at the way a line is delivered that wasn't necessarily a funny line, and he'd be like, why is that funny? I'm like, I could hear my aunt say it exactly that way, you know? So I totally get what you're saying. Like there's things about inflections and the tiniest cultural specificities where you're like, oh yeah, that's Bing. You nailed it. So I get it. And I get that that's a whole layer of this movie that I'm glad it's there. And obviously the those who know will know, but you know, it's not something that I would have picked up on.
I'll say that I cackled many times at the grandma's delivery. And you guys, I don't speak Korean. I know it seems like I might, but I do not. Vote.
All righty. It is voting time. So for Minari, would you snap it up on physical media, stream it, or skip it? Ingu, you're our guest. You go first.
Obviously, if we're using like this categorization, it would be Snap It Up. But I think that the only thing I really, really feel about this movie at this point in time is I really wish I could see this on the big screen. I feel like so much of like the cinematography and the way like the light hits like the fucking grass just like swaying in the breeze, and just like the contours of that trailer, there are so many things I really wish I was able to access on the big screen, and it's a real bummer for me that I've only ever seen this movie on my laptop.
Dave still wants to know if they built a storm cellar because that tornado freaked him out. Drea?
I am a Snap It Up on physical media for this, for sure. I think that I would also like to see it on the big screen, but I think one of the things we only sort of touched on, so Steven Yeun, and what's the other actress's name, the wife?
Han Yeri.
She's incredible. Like, obviously, he's nominated and the grandmother's nominated, but I was watching the two of them, and if, you know, if you've ever watched anyone have relationship troubles, if you've ever gone through arguments or silences or things where you're drifting, I think the two of them are so powerful together, and there's such a love story at the center of this that was unexpected because there's all this other stuff woven in. So I'm a Snap It Up gal for many reasons. Even I would just get it to stare at him because, you know, he's beautiful. But for non-pervy, ugly reasons, a lot of good filmmaking.
This is the dawning of the age of Steven Yeun, no question. I'm a stream it, and it may be that if I do get to see it projected, or if I, you know, watch it again at some point down the road when it's, you know, the current hype has passed and I can just sort of take it more at face value, that it will speak more to me. I can in no way impugn its competence, but it's not rocking my world. But if you like it, I get why you like it, and I don't think you're wrong, and I would never, like, you know, contradict you when you say you like a movie.
Amazing.
Because that's just how I am. Anyway.
Low-key burn.
Yes.
I didn't like Veneno either.
Put some salve on it.
Get us out of this segment. Get us out of here.
We might be right back. I don't know if we all will. After we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Well, hello. I'm Renee Colvert.
Hi, I'm Alexis Preston, and we are the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog?
And we got breaking news, we got an exposé, and all the beans have been spilled via an Apple Podcast review that said, this show isn't well-researched. Well, yeah, no duh. Of course it's not. Not since the day we started has it been well-researched. Guessing and anthropomorphizing dogs is what we do.
The Can I Pet Your Dog promise is that we will never do more than 10 seconds of research before telling you excitedly about any dog we see.
I'm going to come at you with top 10 enthusiasm, minimal facts.
We're here for a good time, not an educated time.
So if you love dogs and you don't love research, well, you know what? Come on in to Can I Pet Your Dog podcast every Tuesday on Maximum Fun Network.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi, and in the studio with me are...
Ingu Kang.
Drea Clark.
And now it's time to listen to a call from the Who Shot line. Casey, play the call, please.
My name is Rob. I'm from Illinois. On Friday, I watched 2001's Joyride, and I've seen the movie many, many times. I'm a big horror thriller buff, and I extremely enjoy Steve Zahn's performance in that movie. What I did not know is that it was co-written and also produced by J.J. Abrams, and the voice of Rusty Nail, who is the villain in the story, is actually Ted Levine, who plays Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. So both of these were like fun, you know, pop-up, almost like pop-up video for me, if you guys remember those from the 90s. So what I'm asking you guys, if you find it humorous and fun, is to pick out a movie that isn't, you know, super duper popular, but maybe someone would scratch their head and be like, oh yeah, I remember that. What are some fun facts that would be in a pop-up video for the film of your choice? So thank you for all that you do. I became a supporter this year, and I'm actually delighted when that $10 gets transferred out of my account because I know it's going to a good cause. So thank you all and have a wonderful day.
Rob!
Oh, thanks, Thanks, Rob. Yeah, it's true. When money goes out of your account to pay for your Max Fun membership, it's a jolt of pleasure, and you shouldn't deny yourself that. Fun question.
Such a good question.
I love a troubled production. Like, you know, I love stories about movies where just like seemingly everything was going wrong, whether it's the shark not working in Jaws or, you know, there's a certain level of schadenfreude I have where I want to hear all the behind the scenes dirt. So like, I would love a pop-up video for something like Last Action Hero or Cutthroat Island or the Liz Taylor Cleopatra, like these just big elephantine productions that just got out of control and the budget skyrocketed and there were just all these other complicating factors to them. I can't get enough of that stuff.
Interesting, Alonzo, because my exact choice was 1963's Cleopatra for many of the same reasons. And yes, I definitely remember pop-up video. I loved it. I don't know why. It's so satisfying. Like, the little things that come up, they're just highly enjoyable. I would like to go through a few of the Cleopatra ones because now I want to make a pop-up video of Cleopatra. It's more like, didn't the final end up at like 4 hours, 11 minutes?
Maybe so.
I mean, bonkers. So I particularly love that they fired, well, first off, they fired the original director and then brought someone else in, Mankiewicz. And then
Joseph Mankiewicz, yeah.
And then they fired Mankiewicz during editing and then had to bring him back because they added on action shoots. So the idea of every few scenes identifying who was the director. Elizabeth Taylor set a world record at the time for 65 costume changes, including a dress made from 24-karat gold cloth. After the first 16 weeks of production and $7 million, they had just 10 minutes of film shot, and then she got ill and they had to recast a bunch of people.
Peter Finch was the original Caesar, right? And then they brought in Rex Harrison.
And then Burton got brought in. And this was, of course, the start of Taylor and Burton's love affair. There was a producer who like brought them out on a yacht for lunch for a day and had all these hidden cameras because he wanted to get a picture of them kissing that he could sell. They had to assemble so many boats and ships for her army that they said at the time that 20th Century Fox had the third largest navy in the world, which is so funny. The Roman Forum they built was three times the size of the actual thing. And then in just a little bit of how far back this goes, the female extras who played Cleopatra's servants and everything went on strike to demand protection from the Italian male extras.
Yes.
And 20th Century Fox had to hire a special guard for the female extras.
I believe that strike was referred to as the Revolt of the Slave Girls.
Yes. Which, you know, just the cherry on top, right? Like, way to read the room with that name. So yes, Cleopatra was, we are very shared. I see you on this because that was my choice. Also, hire me to make that pop-up video.
Ingu, you got anything for this one?
Yeah, I would say basically any Bong Joon-ho movie minus Snowpiercer, which sucks, just like Banana. Because
it's amazing how wrong you can be in one episode.
He is a director who really loves cramming in as many in-jokes as possible, in-jokes and sort of Easter eggs as possible. And I am Korean-American, but I am not a Korean person. And so there are definitely cultural stuff that goes over my head. I took a Korean class when I was in grad school, and we watched, like, I think, like, the first, like, 10 minutes of The Host. And basically our professor was explaining to us, like, in the first like 1 minute of like the monster coming out of the river to attack the people in the park in Seoul, there's like 5 jokes. And the thing is that like all you really have are people like running away from the monster and screaming. But if you know, for example, that like online apparently like close to 15 years ago, there used to be a insult on the Korean internet about like orange girls basically being Korean women who are like too into American culture. For instance, you have like a 1 second shot of like a woman eating an orange, and like she's sort of like and she's just sort of like lying there while this like American made monster is like coming at her. There's little things like that where you, I guess, like need like hyper specific cultural competency in order to get it. And I am going to admit, like, I don't have every single one of those references.
And so, they let you write the essay for the Parasite Blu-ray.
Sorry, say that while I'm not in the middle of laughing.
Yes, so, if you didn't know, Ingu wrote the Criterion Collection.
Dre, I can't stop laughing that they allowed me to do it either.
For us dummies, you're an expert. So, yeah. So like Rob, you can email us at whoshotya@maximumfun.org or call the Who Shot line at WSY803-1664. Thank you to everybody who has submitted a question. We will do our best to get to all of them. And now it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Ingu, kick us off.
Okay, I'm going to come at you guys with two recommendations. Stick with me. One is that because I wrote the Criterion Collection essay for Parasite, I was invited recently to do a panel for a Japanese-American senior center comparing Parasite with the 2018 movie Shoplifters. That was just like a surprisingly really great discussion. And Shoplifters is such a great movie.
Yeah.
And so that is going to be my movie recommendation. Honestly, I don't even want to tell you anything about it except that it is very similar to and very different from Parasite. That's like literally all I will tell you.
I endorse that one. That's for sure. Great.
And then my other recommendation is going to be TV related, which is HBO.
Veneno.
Cállate la boca. Which is HBO Max's British miniseries. It's a sin. It's going to sound depressing. A decade-spanning miniseries about the AIDS crisis in London. But as incredibly depressing as that sounds, it's just like an exhilarating watch in so many ways at the same time. It does not in any way sort of like undersell you like the tragedy of the plague on any level, but I think it has such great characters and such a sense of like the exuberance that these men got to have before AIDS stole it from them. And it is like by far the best thing that I have watched on TV so far in 2021.
It's good.
Wow.
Says the gay man who remembers the 80s.
Okay.
I don't love it the way a lot of people do, but there's a lot I like about it. Drea, what do you got?
I have, you know, with the idea of independent films looking at immigration stories in very personal ways, and the Minnesota films that I've been watching. There's a film from 2005 called Sweetland that I revisited for this draft. I loved it when I first saw it. I loved it again when I watched it now. It stars Elizabeth Reeser and then Lois Smith is the oldest version of her and Tim Guinea. And it's about this German woman who comes to America in the 1930s to marry a Norwegian farmer in Minnesota. It's basically a mail order bride, but she's meant to be Norwegian and shows up and she's German. And this is just after the war. And they are not allowed to marry because she is German and doesn't have papers. And it's a love story, a rural love story. And my favorite kind of love story, because it is truly about the connection grown between two people. It's not just like, oh, the two hottest actors on screen are going to be in love. It is moments of them finding solace or pieces of themselves in the other person, while also having this, it's really beautifully rich period detail for an indie, and shot in Minnesota, the best state. So yes, Sweetland is
the woman
is on
who no longer lives there.
The best state to leave once you come of age. And it's currently on Tubi.
A great place to have been.
A great place, yes. Minnesota, the best state to grow up in and then leave behind for the worm. Yeah.
For me, this Friday, the day that this episode drops, Disney Plus launches The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which is the much anticipated latest MCU show now that WandaVision is over. I'm going to be calling it the Adepero Oduye show while it's on because she's on it, which I'm very excited about. But of course, the lead is Anthony Mackie, who plays the Falcon. And one of his earliest lead roles was in a great queer film called Brother to Brother, which was unavailable for a while. It was out of print on physical media and you couldn't stream it. Again, folks, this is why I always keep harping on physical media. Movies can just disappear on you. If you don't actually have it on your shelf, if some weird rights thing or who the hell knows what, and it'll just be gone. Anyway, Brother to Brother is back. It's on the Criterion Channel, and it is a film that is about Mackie plays a 21st century college student who is doing research into the Harlem Renaissance. And then there are these beautiful black and white sequences that are set among the Harlem Renaissance writers and artists with, people playing like Zora Neale Hurston and people like that. It's a gorgeous film. I really love it. And I'm just so excited people can see it again. So go check that out on Criterion Channel, especially if Falcon and the Winter Soldier has you all, Team Anthony Mackie all over again. Now it is the time on the show where we read a 5-star review. And lucky us, we have one from our dear friend, A Blender. If you send us your 5-star review, we will read it on the show. Leave that review, obviously, on Apple Podcasts. A Blender writes, love these guys. The hosts are kind people with interesting perspectives and opinions who aren't afraid to disagree with each other. Anyone who is interested in progressive modern film critique / analysis should give them a listen. Well, I've always thought so. Thank you. That is very kind of you to
that
say.
That was very nice, A Blender.
Yes. May all your settings be well. Ingu, always a treat to have you with us.
Yay, Ingu.
Where can people find you online? What are you plugging? What's happening?
People can find me on Twitter at Ingu King, INKOOKANG. I have actually a couple of different Minari things to plug. Stick with me. Number one, Minari has kept me very busy, actually, because a lot of people suddenly want, like, the closest Korean-American critic they know to come be on the show. Not that I'm accusing anyone here of doing that. No, I'm obviously very happy to
It's your
here.
Happiest season. I hear you.
That movie sucked. Just kidding.
Woman!
So the very first discussion that I did was on a podcast called Criticism is Dead. And that was, I think, if you liked my contributions here, that was a really fun discussion because it was three daughters of immigrants, basically, having a discussion. And I think, not to take away from anything from our discussion here, but it was just like a very different kind of discussion. So if you are interested in stuff like that, Criticism is Dead. And I also did a interview with Lee Isaac Chung for The Hollywood Reporter that I thought was honestly just like amazing. Gonna brag, he cried like during the interview slightly. That came out really well.
And then you stopped hitting him.
Yes. And then finally, I am on Wednesday's episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour this week. Oh. And Aisha Harris and I are talking about Steven Yeun's career, which I think is like remarkably singular and sort of groundbreaking in very notable ways. especially for an Asian American star. And I really foreground the important role that like his going to Korea and making films with Korean auteurs and then coming back to the US as basically the kind of leading man that he hadn't been before going to Korea, how that plays a role in his career trajectory. So, yeah.
See, you get the invites, but you bring different shit to every table. And that's what makes, that's why you keep it fresh, Ingo.
I have a lot of shit, so I'm happy to spread it around.
This is why you're a get. So we're thrilled that we can sell it.
I actually have a nice pop-up video about Ingo and Minari, which is, she was the unofficial for the Golden Globes. She was my copy edit, or my like proofreading of how to pronounce the name Minari was Ms. Ingu Kang, because I
hope I was credited, Drea.
Yeah, well, I wasn't credited for anything, so I don't know why he would be. But I liked that I read that, because when we first got the copy for it, there was a D in like the pronunciation guide, and I was like, this can't be right. And then I sent it to Ingu, and she thought it was a typo. So I was like, okay, we're taking the D out. Thank you.
Before we wrap it up, we have a small favor to ask to all of our listeners. Please let us know what this show means to you. And to those who financially support the show, like Rob, our caller this week, tell us why you do it. We want to hear from you. So drop an email at memberstories@MaximumFun.org or call us at 323-601-8719. That's 323-601-8719. This will be in, the number will be in the show notes for the episode if you're driving or whatever. So please call in and let us know. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Ya Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast, or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.